The weakening of institutional checks and balances in Sri Lanka have affected the state's ability to effectively tackle the economic crisis.
Turbulence in Sri Lanka. It's Thursday, April 7th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us online. Join us at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, Aussie mosquitoes turn deadly. Trafficking Ukrainian refugees. Fighting Russia's information war. Taxing the super rich. Kashmir's pencil village. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The United Nations Human Rights Office is urging the Sri Lankan government to engage in peaceful dialogue, not violence, to quell rising discontent over the country's economic crisis. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Tensions have been rising since Sri Lanka announced a state of emergency and other restrictions a few days ago. The action was taken to rein in mass gatherings of people protesting the country's worst economic crisis in decades. UN Human Rights spokeswoman Liz Throssell says there are worrying signs that the government is losing patience with the largely peaceful demonstrations taking place across the country. She says people are demanding action to stem the rising cost of living, shortages of fuel and other essential commodities.
We have seen brutality in the past, and I understand it, that there were a number of arrests, dozens of arrests, 50 or so people were detained in response to one of the protests. And there was, as I said, reports of excessive and unwarranted police violence against protesters.
Throssell says there's concern that the state of emergency will be used to stifle dissent and people's right to freedom of expression and assembly. She says using emergency powers to prevent people from expressing grievances through peaceful protests would violate international human rights law. She says United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, previously has voiced concern about repressive measures taken by the government in response to criticism of its policies.
As the High Commissioner noted in her recent report to the Human Rights Council in February, the drift towards militarization and the weakening of institutional checks and balances in Sri Lanka have affected the state's ability to effectively tackle the economic crisis and ensure the realization of the economic, social, and cultural rights of all people in Sri Lanka.
Throssell says the High Commissioner believes meaningful dialogue between the government and political and civic critics would offer solutions to the economic and political crisis facing the country. She adds, the Human Rights Office will be closely watching developments. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As developments continue in Sri Lanka, you can follow it with us on Twitter at VOA Asia, also on Facebook, and at our website, voanews.com. Let's continue with VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The deadly mosquito-borne virus, Japanese encephalitis, is sweeping across Australia, where the youngest patient is just 4 months old. Phil Mercer in Sydney tells us several people have been infected so far. Some have died.
Japanese encephalitis is a disease of the brain. Severe cases are rare, and experts have said that fewer than 1% of people who contract the mosquito-borne virus will experience symptoms. But they can be serious and include lifelong side effects, including speech and movement disorders. Most people, however, don't know they're infected, while others might suffer a mild flu-like illness. Japanese encephalitis is endemic in much of Asia and parts of the Pacific, but authorities don't know how it arrived in Australia. Outbreaks were common in northern Australia in the 1990s, and scientists have said it's been detected ever since during the Southern Hemisphere summers. However, the outbreak in southern parts of Australia is unprecedented. Migrating water birds are thought to bring the virus into new areas. Farmed pigs are what are called amplifier hosts, which harbour the virus. It spreads when mosquitoes bite an infected bird or pig, and when they bite a person. Human-to-human transmission is not thought to be possible. Dr. David Williams is the leader of the Emergency Disease Laboratory Diagnosis Group at the Australian Centre for Disease Preparedness.
For the first time, and this is really unprecedented, we're seeing this very large outbreak in southeast Australia, in the southeastern states of Queensland, New South Wales, South Australia and Victoria. We think it's probably been supported by the La Nina climatic conditions that have been prevailing over the last season, that's led to generally wetter conditions, some of the flooding that we've seen in some parts, and that's really supported mosquito breeding sites. But also, those wetter areas in the southeast have attracted water birds, so migratory water birds are attracted to waterways, and when that happens, they can bring viruses with them.
The government has recently purchased from suppliers in the Australian market 130,000 doses of a Japanese encephalitis vaccine for at-risk communities. It's also spending millions of dollars advising Australians on how to avoid mosquito bites and eradication programs. Dengue and Ross River fever, which can cause severe arthritis and muscle pain, are other mosquito-borne infections in Australia. Malaria was declared eradicated from Australia in 1981, although up to 800 cases are reported each year, and travellers have been infected elsewhere. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Still ahead on VOA Asia, taking advantage of refugees from Ukraine. It's great to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thanks for joining us. 4 million people have fled Ukraine since the beginning of Russia's invasion, according to United Nations data. The vast majority are women and children, populations that are especially vulnerable to human trafficking. Lesia Bakalets has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
This is the Ukrainian-Polish border, the Shehini-Medyka checkpoint. According to the latest UN data, a large proportion of Ukrainian refugees, mostly women and children, fled to Poland after Russia invaded Ukraine. Many spent days waiting to cross the border.
It's very tough, of course. I don't know what else to say, but we have no choice. We need to save the children.
Since the very start of Russia's aggression, human rights activists have been warning refugees that they could be targeted by human traffickers.
The risks have definitely increased, mostly because women who cross the border with children have found themselves in an extremely vulnerable position from an economic point of view as well as psychological. They are fleeing a war. People are easier to manipulate when they are in such a state.
Human rights activist Yulia Anosova says human trafficking typically involves both sexual exploitation and violence. Polish police have already registered 2 cases of rape among refugees. Volunteers are working to inform women who might be at risk.
We've seen men taking pictures of women and teenage girls. We very quickly understood that human traffickers could be behind this.
A woman from the Kiev region was looking for a job in Lviv. She found an employment ad, got in touch with a person of contact who offered her a job as a nanny for a 15-year-old boy. Part of the job was offering sexual services.
Refugees also risk being exploited at work. The scheme is very simple. Living quarters may be offered for free at first, and once the refugees arrive, they find out it's anything but free. Human rights activists emphasize such actions are illegal.
If there is an expectation for work, then the work should be paid. And very important. Moreover, if you have to work in the place where you live, where there is the same owner that requires you to work, I don't know, in a hotel, in a, I don't know, farm or whatever, and you are being hosted, that is a sign that you need to be, you know, to be aware that this is a vulnerable situation.
Half of the displaced Ukrainians are children. Some cross the border without any papers. Some cross the border alone without parents. Such children are at risk of ending up with someone suspicious or worse.
Missing is a result of gaps in the protection system, and gaps in the protection system are the same kinds of issues that track traffickers.
The organization called Missing Children Europe asks refugees to immediately report any missing children using their hotline. They also encourage adults to be watchful, and if they see a child looking lost and alone in the street, to immediately alert local authorities. For women, there is also advice about how not to become a victim of human traffickers.
Ask for an ID card, for identifying them, if they have some car from the organization or something like that, to go to the tent to see if they have a tent. It's very important. If they have a tent with their name in the border, it means that it's a safe organization.
Experts also advise refugees to take pictures of important documents on their phone, stay in a group, and keep handy the phone number for the police in any country they enter. It's also important to have contact information for volunteers and aid groups, and keep in touch with relatives and close friends, so that as many people as possible know the location of each refugee. For Леся Бакалец in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Join us at VOA Asia Facebook to read and see more on this story.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
Much more is ahead on VOA Asia. Right now, the Kremlin's clampdown on news of the war in Ukraine has hackers and volunteers from around the world texting directly to Russian citizens' phones to keep them informed. No texting needed. You can hear Matt Dibble right now with the story.
Some are calling it the digital Iron Curtain. Since the beginning of its invasion of Ukraine, the Russian government has increased its control over news reaching its citizens. It has blocked most social media in the country and silenced independent news outlets through a new law criminalizing war reporting.
We don't need to buy guns. Our weapons are our smartphones.
Using a stolen database of millions of Russian phone numbers, a group of cyber activists based in Poland has created an easy way for anyone to send news of the war directly to Russian citizens.
Thanks to all these people, we were able to send more than 40 million text messages, emails, WhatsApp messages to Russians.
Using a pseudonym honoring a Polish war hero, Jan Zumbach says his group was inspired by similar efforts during the Cold War.
I can remember my parents and me listening to Radio Free Europe because it was the only source of knowledge about the truth about the world.
The 1920.in website supplies a phone number and suggested text in Russian. Sending a message takes just seconds. Kathy, a teacher in San Francisco, who asked to not include her last name for privacy reasons, uses the site to appeal directly to Russians.
I said, children's hospital, maternity hospitals, and a theater where citizens were sleeping were bombed. It's a tragedy for Russia as well as Ukraine.
She includes headlines and photos from a variety of news outlets.
I think I sent 95 or 96, and I heard back from about 12 people.
Some of the responders questioned the news stories.
She wrote back, I'm sorry you believe this information. It's far from reality. I like to think that I'm planting a seed, if nothing else, that, you know, that maybe there's more for them to consider.
Anis Sherbi, a 19-year-old in Tunisia who shares his artwork on social media, has sent over 100 messages.
I got one reply so far, and this reply told me that I'm a liar, and that what's going on in Ukraine is a lawful, heroic act.
Undeterred, Sherbi has been fine-tuning his messages to make them more personal.
I think that there is hope to make them understand what's actually going on. So I have faith in the Russian people, honestly.
Fear of government surveillance may keep some Russians from responding. But Zumbach says that the messages are still having an impact, and the Russian government has been trying to take down the 1920.in website.
It's something terrible not to have an access to information from the West and, you know, the rest of the globe, basically. It's a burden. So I believe that one day more and more people will start the dialogue.
Matt Dibble for VOA News, San Francisco, California.
Now on VOA Asia, in his newly released budget plan, U.S. President Joe Biden has proposed a 20% minimum tax on households with a net worth of more than $100 million. The proposal will not likely get the support it needs to become law this year, but it highlights the debate over what the government should do about the soaring fortunes of America's wealthiest people. VOA's Laurel Bowman has more.
One of the world's richest women, Mackenzie Scott, has given away more than $12 billion in the past 2 years, sending money to more than 1,200 groups focused on racial justice, climate change, education, abortion rights, relief for the war in Ukraine, human rights, and others.
We get to use this funding in the way that our communities and our stakeholders want us to use this funding in a strategic way, so we're really excited.
The ex-wife of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos is more generous than her former husband, whose net worth is in the hundreds of billions of dollars. The United States has the most billionaires in the world, and so the question is often posed, with so much money out there, should U.S. tax collectors get more of it? President Joe Biden says yes.
A firefighter and a teacher pay more than double the tax rate that a billionaire pays. That's not right. That's not fair. And my budget contains a billionaire minimum tax because of that. A 20% minimum tax that applies only to the top 1/100 of 1%. 1/100 of 1% of the Americans will pay this tax.
Biden says billionaires currently pay an average of 8% of their total income in taxes.
We find that some of the wealthiest people in the country actually can often pay little or no income taxes. And that's because their major source of income doesn't count each year. And that is not the income they get from their salaries, but really it's the growth in their assets.
Other experts say that rich people pay plenty when all forms of taxation are added up, as much as 32% of their incomes. And they give financially to the economy in other ways.
The vast majority of wealth of millionaires and billionaires is actually business ownership. Most of Jeff Bezos's wealth is his ownership in Amazon Corporation, which hires over a million people a year now. So I don't want Jeff Bezos paying more taxes and withdrawing the value from Amazon.
Biden says his billionaire tax would bring in $360 billion in federal revenue. It's not likely to pass the Senate this year, but proponents say a wave is building to impose a wealth tax with clear majorities of Americans saying some of the country's richest don't pay their fair share. Laurel Boomen, VOA News, Washington.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers using two telescopes in Hawaii imaged for the very first time the final 130 days of a dying massive star before it blew up into a Type 2 supernova. According to a press release from the W.M. Keck Observatory, the red supergiant star had a mass 10 times that of our sun and located 120 million light years away in a galaxy called NGC 5731. The supernova was named SN 2020 TLF. The star was first spotted by scientists with the Pan-STAR system at the Haleakala Observatory in the summer of 2020 and were joined by colleagues at the Keck Observatory. Astronomers at both facilities spent a few months observing the dying star until its life ended with a massive cosmic explosion in the fall of 2020. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA Zubair Dar brings us the story of Pencil Village, where a factory provides two-thirds of the wood needed to make pencils in India, which exports the old school writing implement to scores of countries. Aisha Khalid narrates this report.
On the outskirts of Kashmir's largest city of Srinagar lies a village known as Pencil Village. It gets its name from the fact that this village provides the wood necessary to make over two-thirds of India's pencils, according to a factory owner.
Jitna matlab pencil Hindustan mein hai, ye 90%.
About 90% of the pencils in India are made from this wood. So with the supply we give them, they're able to make and sell pencils in 83 countries.
This business generates income that sustains Oko Village, which is made up of about 250 families. But like many communities, COVID-19 hit this village hard.
Before COVID, our daily production was 300 bags. We used to make anywhere between $1.5 to $1.7 million a year. During COVID, we saw our numbers fall to between $250,000 to $400,000. We had to reduce the number of workers to 30% and could only keep technical workers on staff.
More than
2,500 people worked in the village's 18 factories prior to the pandemic, including a large number of local women. However, pandemic-induced school closures in much of the world lowered demand for pencils, and factory owners were forced to cut their workforce.
When a child goes to school, only then will they spend money for pencils and causing our production to continue. If the schools get closed, then our jobs will be lost and our employment is affected.
But with the schools reopening and demand picking up again, hundreds of workers are now back to work.
Life can have ups and downs, but pencils will always be used as it's required for education. Much like a child's future depends on pencils and early education, this factory's future also depends on pencils.
For Zubair Dar in Srinagar, Kashmir, Aisha Khalid, VOA News.
That's our program for today. We're glad you were with us on VOA Asia. Continue online. You'll find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Of course, voanews.com. We thank our team, Service Chief Diane Gao, Keith Lane, Chris Kiskejo, and Jessica Stone. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead. Be safe. Be well.